Having transformational conversations. This is the Black and Irish podcast.
What this masters did was it did not reduce the Nigerian problem. It just made me see it for what it was on a microscopic level from the global perspective. So I can see where the Nigerian problem is on the large scale, and that frightens me, and it makes me understand that there's still like a lot of work to be done.
Welcome back to another episode of the Black and Irish podcast. You're joined here today by Femi Bankole and my co-host,
Leon Job.
We have two fantastic guests for you guys here today. We're joined first of all by Moyonluwa Adelakun, who's a human rights lawyer from Nigeria. And we're joined by Oluwafunmilayo Oni, who is an activist also from Nigeria. And they're both here in Ireland on the Roger Casement Fellowship program. Ladies, how are you doing?
Fine. It's nice to be here.
Yeah.
So how's your experience been so far?
Oh, a mixture of different things, but the most prominent thing would be an amazing experience. Like, I've loved every minute of being here. It's been such a learning experience for me. I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned a lot about my career path. I've learned a lot about human rights on an international scale generally. And I've learned a lot about people from different continents, countries, walks of life. So it's been a very full experience.
I think it's been a wonderful experience. We've been here for 7 months-ish. And I think when I was coming here, I did think I was going to explore the Irish scene a lot. But because we live on campus, we live with lots of international students. So it's been really beneficial, not just meeting Irish people, but I've got German friends, American Brilliant. Friends, Chinese friends, Indians, like quite a wonderful experience and very multidimensional. Every day something new happens.
Okay, and what's one thing that surprises you about Ireland that you weren't expecting?
I think they did a good job of preparing us to come here. We got like a lot of soft landing, but I think what has surprised me the most is how respectful the Irish people are. People would wait like 3 minutes to hold the door for me to walk through, and I'm like, wow, like, and I'm running trying to get to the door because I'm like, oh, I don't want you to wait that long. And everyone, when we came, we had loads of boxes and people were so helpful. That was surprising. And it wasn't just on that day, in school, outside of school, everywhere, people really, really want to help. And people would even ask, oh, are you okay? Like, yeah, that was a very big culture shock.
Brilliant. Yeah. And what about you, Ayo? Was there anything that surprised you when you came to Ireland?
Yes, people are very, very warm, yeah. And that's another good. Very surprising thing is the rain.
I like the weather.
It's the rain, really. We're told that our feet, our shoes are always going to be dirty, but seeing is believing. I remember my first day here, I saw students and their shoes were very dirty, and I told me, this is a clean country. Why is everyone's shoes dirty? But now look at me, my shoes are always dirty.
Yeah, I buy a new pair of Air Force, like, big spender on runners.
Maybe you should give them some additional context about what the Roger Casement Fellowship is.
It's a fellowship program that started in, I think, 2016. It hasn't been too long. And it's basically sponsors, is a scholarship for human rights activists in Nigeria. So the scholarship has different dimensions in different countries. For some countries, they sponsor, you know, those in health and science. But for Nigeria, it's specifically for human rights related courses. And every year they choose one. It was usually one Nigerian every year. And it's a very competitive process for us in Nigeria because loads of people apply. But in our sets, thankfully, they picked three of us.
So amazing.
Myself, Ayo, and Mayrose, who was not able to make it here today, were the ones that were chosen out of a very huge, cabal of applicants. So we're really thankful to be here. Yeah.
And like, would it just be people in human rights courses, or like, as you mentioned that you're an activist, So are you currently studying in human rights as well?
Yes, I'm studying the Master's in Equality Studies.
Oh, brilliant.
So basically what I'm doing is to study the basic theories behind inequalities, like why are things the way they are, the poor, the rich, minority groups, majority groups. So you don't necessarily have to study law for you to understand, for you to work in human rights.
Yeah.
I've been working in human rights in Nigeria for over 9 years, since I was a teenager. And there are so many courses that you could study that are not exactly human rights law.
Right.
For example, if you are doing the Master's in Disability Studies, if you are studying the Master's in Gender Studies, they are all human rights issues.
Of course.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so that's just brilliant. To be clear, so you guys came on top of this extremely competitive process in Nigeria,
yeah.
and the event was to come to Ireland to study a human rights course. I think you guys are in UCD.
Yes, we are.
For the next year.
Yes.
But as you're saying, you guys have, you know, it's not like you're just like, you know, graduates who just came out of college in Nigeria. No, no, no. Yeah. So maybe, Moin, if you want to start with you, tell us a bit about your background so far.
I grew up with watching my mom as a lawyer, and I was very inspired by the whole process of it. But I lived with my grandma, and growing up with my grandma was a very interesting experience for me because, first of all, as a young girl, that really shapes, you know, your outlook on life. And seeing the kind of things that I saw growing up, especially growing up in a community like Ojuelegba, it was, if you know Ojuelegba, Ojuelegba is one of the slums back in Lagos, in Nigeria. And it gave me a perspective of life that I would not have understood if I didn't grow up there. The inequalities, the gross human rights violations that were happening. And I was the child that was always challenging authority because it just did not sit down well with me that a lot of things were going wrong. And the women that raised me were very outspoken. And so naturally, I was outspoken about a lot of things that were happening. But I was always an outlier. I felt a lot of times that I didn't fit in. And so I joined the debate team back in primary school. And then from there, you know, went to secondary school, same thing, and then applied to study law in university. And my study of law kind of gave depth to this passion that had been inside of me for a very long time. And then I came across a particular class that changed my entire scenario of life. It was my public international law class. And my lecturer was amazing. Professor Odombana is one teacher that I will never forget in my life because he gave a voice to a lot of the questions that I had for a very long time. And that was when I decided that I was going to, you know, start to work in the human rights space, which was not something that a lot of people wanted to hear because, you know, most of my friends were going into oil and gas, commercial law, equity, land law, family law. It was not a class. We were just five out of a class of 70. We were just five that were in the class. So it was not something that was celebrated. I went to law school and I was very disappointed because in law school in Nigeria, we were only taught procedural things about civil procedures, criminal procedures, nothing really emphasizing on what human rights should be. And they were raising activists. So that was very surprising to see that we were just taught this bunch of rules. Even in court, I went to court and it was once again the same thing to see the human rights process and everything. But something that stood out for me during my law school externship was the sexual offenses courts that Lagos State had. I think Lagos State is the only state that has a well-developed program for that in Nigeria. So it was very interesting to see those processes happen in court and see how civil societies and NGOs relate with the legal community to bring cases of gross human rights violations in different aspects, especially as regards women's rights, to the forefront. And I thought it was phenomenal. It was always so much fun. I could be in court all day and I would not be tired. And I wasn't posted to the sexual offences court, but I was always there because of how interesting the cases were. So I went from that to work with NGOs. I worked with an NGO that specifically dealt with drug addiction in Nigerian youth. And that was also a very interesting process to see how, you know, the fight against drug abuse, especially in low-income communities, was in Nigeria. Then I went from there to an organization which was specific about women and children's rights. And I worked there for another 2 years. And then I went to work with an organization known as Project Enable Africa, where I was very privileged to be part of the bill signing process for Nigeria's first disability bill. That was very interesting, and to work on disability issues across Nigeria. It was not just working on disability issues in Nigeria that gave me the perspective that I felt I needed, but working with other organizations, even outside of Nigeria, organizations that were funding programs to support persons with disabilities in Nigeria. And it gave me, like, I love how these colorful experiences have given me different perspectives of various human rights issues across border. And yeah, I think that they've shaped me and have helped me to create the platform that has brought me to where I am today. So brilliant. Yeah, in a nutshell, that's everything.
In a nutshell. Oh my gosh. That's an incredible journey.
Yeah.
And like, it's very inspirational. So yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that with us.
So I'm trying to put it in a nutshell. So I'm trying to figure out how that can do it.
No. Take your time. It's okay. Okay. We have all day.
So I think for me, my journey here, where I am right now, is inspired by so many things. The things that I see, my personal journey as a person, and just my environment too. You know, for many young people, especially for many children of my generation, many of us did not have supportive fathers. And then when you look at the journey of the girls, you would find out that some of the fathers were particularly not interested in their well-being or in supporting their education because they're girls. And they believe that when she's 20, she's going to get married. Why do I have to put my energy into funding this girl's education? Why do I have to put my energy into raising her? She's going to take another man's surname. So my mom raised me. She raised me and my siblings. She raised us alone. And throughout my journey, my father was never present for me and for my brother too. So it wasn't just because I was female, which was just a whole bunch of things. And I would see a lot of women, Nigerian women, who had husbands in court, but their husbands were nowhere to be found when it's time for them to take care of the families, but they were the head of the house. I like to make that joke. So it was just like that. I would see many women like my mom struggle to put food on the table, to go to work, and they were doing all these things and doing amazing. And I would always question it, like, why? Because I always find it very appalling that every time there's this discussion of a man being the head of the home, the breadwinner, the leader of the family. But in my own immediate environment, I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing their impact. Right. Why do we have so many single mothers with loads of children who are raising their kids alone? What's the impact of these men? Where are they? So, you know, I had all these questions every time people came up. I couldn't even define what I felt. I couldn't define exactly what was going on within me. I just knew that there was something not right about this. So that was my journey into advocacy for women. I just always said things like, why? Why is this happening? So when I went to the uni, I studied, I enrolled to study economics and education in Nigeria. And in my first year, I noticed that many girls in that community were not going to school. Why? Poverty, one. Two, because of poverty, there's this kind of hierarchy where families decide who is going to go to school. We have four children, three girls, one boy. The girl is the firstborn, the boy is the second boy. We can't afford to send everyone. Who do we send to school? Let's enroll the boy in school. Why? Because we don't have money, and a boy is supposed to grow, become the head of the family, get married. So he needs more money, he needs more education than the girl. Like, if you want to use age, it should be the girl. Or perhaps let's test their intelligence, or let's try and source for funding for all of them. Why do girls have to be the ones at a disadvantage? So I just saw that this was really not right. So at a whim, I wasn't even thinking. Like, it was just a decision I made at the spot that I was going to set up a non-profit organization. So at 19, I established a non-profit organization in Nigeria. It's called the Enroll Foundation.
Wow.
We would go online, raise funding for girls' education. We'll raise money to train women on skills that they can use to start a business. We would help women raise funding for their business. We would support them healthcare. We would work in providing shelter for women and girls who are in abusive situations. We are like 9 years old. We are amazing. And when we started, one day we had trained some girls who did not, out of school girls, like 19, 20, who never had access to education. We trained them on fashion designing skill. In the particular community where we train them, girls have to have a graduation party for them to be recognized as, for them to be recognized as fashion designers. If you don't have a graduation party, if you don't wear that robe, yeah. if you don't have that certificate, people would not think of you as fit enough to be able to sew for them. So that party is very, very important.
It's called freedom.
It's called freedom. Yeah. So it is very, very important to them in that community. So we set up the party that we are going to have this party for you girls on so day. Everyone was excited. They bought clothes and all that. And on the day of the party, one of our best students, she was our best student, didn't show up at the party. Where's she? You know, 2 hours, 3 hours, we didn't see her. And someone just came to tell us that, oh, this girl, she has been abducted by a man who was supposed to marry her. So he abducted her because he felt that once she becomes a certified fashion designer, she's going to become financially dependent and his influence over her is going to be reduced. So didn't want that. And he actually abducted her in partnership with her father. So he had her father's blessing to abduct her, but he didn't have her mother's blessing. So overnight, when she meant to make her, they live on a floating slum. A floating slum means living on a river or on the ocean. They live on the ocean.
Right.
Yeah, so they live on the ocean. And then he abducted her, put her on a boat, and drove her overnight from
one island.
One island to the other.
Yeah.
So it's like driving her from Ireland to the UK.
Wow.
Yes. So it's what he drove her from Lagos to Benin Republic. Those are two different communities that share a border, but people go in and come out. So we for days we didn't see her. We were trying to look for her and all that. And she finally came home about 2 weeks later. She told us about her journey, how she did not eat, she did not change her clothes because she wasn't sure if they were going to poison her. How everyone in the new community welcomed her because everyone knew that he was going to abduct and bring her. So everyone was excited. Yeah, his wife. So, and after that, many of our students came out and say, oh, I have 3 kids with my husband. That was how they carried me too. I never wanted to marry him. But now that I'm with him, he doesn't take care of me. Sometimes a bulk of our students will come and say they cannot come, they are not coming again because their husband is angry that they are not cooking or they are not going to pick the children up from school. And it's not like these men are exactly doing anything important, you know. So all of these things really angered me. And then we tried to focus our work on advocacy and understanding the root cause of this issue. So in Nigeria, I did work on lots of policies. I worked on the Domestication of the Child Rights Act. The Child Rights Act is basically policies that talks about the right of children, access to education, access to healthcare, food, shelter. I worked on the Domestication of the Violence Against Persons Prohibition Act. It's an act that also talks about like the different rules and policies in place to support survivors of violence. I also worked on increasing the budgetary allocation for the Ministry of Women Affairs through the United Nations Spotlight in Lagos State. And that was because during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a surge in cases of sexual and gender-based violence.
Right.
That was a global problem, and it was a big thing in Lagos, Nigeria. And the funding allocated was nowhere near enough for them. So we worked on helping them increase the budgetary allocation. And really, I did see that I have like 9 years of experience of doing all these things. And while my work is interesting, amazing, I felt I had an introspection that I needed to understand why people behave this way. Why do we have all these things in place? Why do we have so many inequalities? why is it that when we try to solve one problem, another problem crop up? There were so many why. What are the things that has happened in years that has made the world what it is today? And what exactly can I do to make it better? Where do I come in? So I started looking for scholarship opportunities that I needed to understand what exactly was happening.
Yeah.
So I looked into gender studies. I looked into, I just stumbled on the master's in equality studies one day, and I thought, oh, this is mm-hmm. what I'm going to do. So I got the Chevening scholarship. I got this, and then I said, okay, this is the best thing for me to do, and now we are here.
Okay, wow.
In a nutshell. In a nutshell.
The two of them said in a nutshell. First thing, what I want to say is it is absolutely impressive, and I am honored and humbled just to be sitting in front of you two ladies today.
Absolutely.
Your stories, the journeys, the work you've done so far, and what you've achieved so far in your life is beyond incredible. I feel the need to say thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel the absolute need to say thank you to you guys. And I suppose my key question is, you know, as you both said, we're both here now, right? And you're here for 1 year on this amazing scholarship, which is a credit to you guys to attain in the first place. So what's the plan after, you know, the next 6 months or after you finish the scholarship?
In the process of doing this, I feel like I now have like more wise. It's funny because the master's on international human rights was supposed to answer many questions. Now I have more questions than answers, and I'm seeing myself like flourish in a lot of things that I didn't even know I could do. Like the educational system here is so amazing. The resources that are available to help, the lecturers are for you. Like that is such, to have that support system.
You can send beyond, emails.
Yes, it's beyond amazing to me to have lecturers even recommend you for opportunities. We both had that, and it's been phenomenal. And so it takes, what this master's did was it did not reduce the Nigerian problem. It just made me see it for what it was on a microscopic level from the global perspective. So I can see where the Nigerian problem is on a large scale, and that frightens me, and it makes me understand that there's still like a lot of work to be done. Watching how the elections and everything have played out in Nigeria, it's been very, very heartbreaking. And we've even had experiences, personal experiences here as well, just because we are Nigerian. And it just makes me more dedicated to the fact that, okay, maybe if I was doing something on a scale of 5 before, I have to like increase it. Like I want to scream at people now, like, you guys are sleeping, we need to do more. Like I feel like we're nowhere near where we need to be. So to put all of this in perspective, yesterday I was speaking with my supervisor, and you know, she's helping me through working on my thesis, and I'm talking about, you know, the human rights violations that occurred in Nigeria during the COVID pandemic, especially as regards the NSARS. If you do not know what the NSARS is, it's one of the biggest protests that Nigeria has ever had, and it was basically about fighting against police brutality. And we were searching the UN database for Nigeria on torture and other issues, and we could see that. So this is how it works. Like, there's supposed to be an updated report of how the country has come since the country signed or ratified a treaty.
Yeah.
And on Nigeria, on almost every treaty, there was nothing to be found. There are some that, as far back as 1998, no one has done a follow-up. And with other countries, you will see these problems being brought to the spotlight. CNN and BBC will be reporting on it. But it's just like silence, cold silence over Nigeria. And she was like, oh my God, why is it like, she kept opening it and she was screaming like, oh my God, like I've never seen this before. Like, now I want to know what the problem is. I'm like, well, I've been telling you, like, yeah, it's really bad. And so it makes me understand that there is a gap in the way NGOs and civil societies have operated in Nigeria, especially as regards their relationship with the international community. We can no longer work in isolation. I think that things have gotten so bad. We now have to connect. We have to pool all our resources to make sure that our government is accountable, and not just accountable in terms of good governance, but in every aspect, women's rights, education, every single thing. We need to hold them accountable, and we cannot do that in isolation. We've done this great work. We've touched a lot of communities back home, but it is not enough if we do not connect with the international community. It's all of that is happening in isolation, and that's what this master's has put me on. Like, there is a need to restructure the way NGOs and civil societies work back home, especially as regards how it reflects in the international community in terms of international law and human rights. And for some reason, I've become fascinated with international armed conflict. I think like that's one of the most interesting modules I have in this semester. And I was thinking about it when I first started the module in terms of, the countries we always hear about, Ukraine, Russia, what is happening in other countries. But when I started to study the conflicts that were happening, I realized that the threshold of violence for the kind of conflicts that occur in Nigeria supersede many of what these countries are even reporting. I'm like, this is not a problem on the Nigerian scale. Like, these people have it better. And so it makes me understand, like, there are a lot of issues about international human rights, international law, that are blind spots back home. And so now, more than ever before, I don't know how I'm going to do all the things I need to do, but yes, there's a lot of work to be done.
Sorry, yeah. I just, you mentioned it there, and it just obviously popped in my head because I've been following for the last 2 weeks, and I think we owe it to just delve into that topic a tiny bit more. And you're talking about the elections back home. And you may raise some key points there. You know, you're so enamored. I can feel your passion, energy to wanting to hold the government accountable.
I need to explain the political landscape a bit for you to understand where we are coming from.
Okay.
One, Nigeria has over 100 tribes, but we have 3 major tribes, which is the Yoruba, Igbo, and Hausa. We also have 2 major religions in Nigeria, which is Christianity and Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So for every political year, these 2 factors play a key role into who is going to be president and who is going to be the VP. So every year, every political year, there is a political zone. That means that these 8 years, if the North, which is the Fulani, the Hausas, and every other zone that is under the North is president this year, next year, it has to go to the South.
Right.
Yes, which are the Yorubas, the Igbos, and other minority tribes that are in the
policy
South.
Or is that the actual policy? Okay,
yes,
right.
It's policy, but it's not a written policy.
Yes, it's just kind of a.
It's not written. Yes. It's just like commonsensical.
And this is why Nigeria's democratic system is quite interesting because we say we elect, but we actually appoint.
Okay.
But this year was different. Yes. So
also, if you had a Muslim president the last year, you have to have a Christian president this year, and his VP has to be Muslim.
Yeah.
So if you had a Muslim president, that you have to have a Christian. So there are so many factors in play for the Nigerian political scenario. And that's one. So our present president is Muslim. He's from the North.
Okay.
His VP is Christian from the South.
Okay.
So what people expect this year is a Christian from the South and a VP, a Muslim VP from the North.
Okay.
If it doesn't exactly play that way, there has to be South North and Christian Muslim one way or the other.
Okay.
Anyways, this year the political kingpin Tinubu is Muslim from the South. He chose a Muslim VP from the North.
Okay.
Which is not in adherence to whatever factors.
The usual,
yes.
Yeah.
Peter Obi is from the South.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is another issue with him being from the South.
Yeah.
He's Igbo. And there's an unspoken rule that an Igbo person
must never be president.
Yeah. Right.
Why?
So,
all the Igbos are screaming right now.
It's a long story, but the long and short of the story is that during the colonial system back in Nigeria.
Shout out to the colonial masters.
Sorry, just for anyone listening, if you can see Leon's face right now, it's a picture.
I'm just like, I did not realize it was Disney.
Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean?
During the colonial regime in Nigeria, a lot of the reason why colonialism was especially successful in Nigeria and why Nigeria was such a prize choice for the colonial masters in Africa was because of the kind of resources they could get. And the only way they could get those resources was to keep Nigeria within regions. Keeping us within regions heightened tribalistic sentiments because of inequality of resources.
Yeah.
So what happened for the North is you would have easy adherence to policies and rules because it is largely a very theocratic scene. They are Muslims. Everybody listens to what the imam says. Nobody disobeys. The Yorubas are very educated. You will not have it as easy. People would argue with you. People, intellectuals would want a debate like, oh, so why is this? Why is this? And Yorubas are quite liberal. We are the only regions that have both Christians and Muslims within our within the tribe. Then the Igbos are Christians. They've never had, like, even their traditional structure did not have a leader, a very right. communal system. So you would not have adherence to anything. There will be lots of fights. The first protest that happened in Nigeria happened from the women at the Aba riots. They were the ones that led the protest. They do not,
right.
it is not always an easy fight. And so because of that, because of easy administration, the British rulers gave a lot of political power to the North because they were easier to rule. And in the creation of states in Nigeria, because of their religion, they allowed to marry four wives. So they had, they were larger in terms of their population.
Right.
So they had 19 states in Nigeria. So if a particular region has 19 states out of 36 states,
yeah,
in a country that has a federal system, you can already see that if the majority always rules,
yeah,
leadership, policies, everything will always come from one region more than the other. But the bone of contention that people have in Nigeria against Igbo people is because, number one, it started with the trade. So they are known for trade. They are economic. They know how to do business. They are businessmen. They do not have a flair for any other thing like business. They even have a culture of training people in business. And so economically, they began to flourish and they started to flourish more than any other region in Nigeria. And at some point in the military scenario in Nigeria, the Igbos were also the ones in the top positions, the army general
of the military. Like, okay.
Yes. So when corruption started to erupt from Nigeria's First Republic, because Nigeria's First Republic was not really an independent republic, a lot of power still came from the British in terms of how we would rule. We had a premier, but the queen still had her say in how the Nigerian government was run. And people were like, this is nonsense. We've gained our independence. We should no longer do this. So it was not surprising that cracks started to show and the military, a military coup was led. But that military coup was led by an Igbo general.
Right.
And so the North saw this as a threat to their hold on power. And so they fought back with a counter coup, killed the Igbo generals and became and reinstated themselves as head of state. Then back and forth, a lot of military coups started to happen, but it was always the Northern leaders that were leading a lot of those coups. Then the Igbos got fed up, like, okay, so we can't continue like this. This is killing our region. We need to do better. But nothing was done. The president of Ghana called when they saw that if Nigeria goes up in flames, it's going to be a big problem for the whole of Africa. Let's solve this now.
Right.
So the president of Ghana calls the general. His name was General Ojukwu, and the general from the northern region go on. They were called to a place in Ghana called Aburi and had a peace agreement called the Aburi Accord, where they spoke to them about, the Igbos, we can solve this. Nigeria needs to have peace for the whole of Africa to reign well. We can't afford to have a crisis in Nigeria. And they agreed to certain terms of agreements that, okay, so the Igbos will no longer be chased out of different regions. They'll be allowed to do business freely and all of that. But then they came back to Nigeria and none of these agreements were met.
Right.
And so they were like, okay, so it's time for the Igbos to secede from Nigeria. And it was successful. They seceded from Nigeria and the oil producing states in Nigeria are in their region.
Okay.
And so the rest of the country sees that this is a threat and this could be a big problem for what it means to be Nigerian, because even other countries are starting to recognize them. They call themselves the Biafran Republic as an independent nation. But they were like, we need to get them back at all costs. And so they re-strategized and changed the legal tender of Nigeria, which made the legal tender that was in the hands of the Biafrans at that time, it made it useless. And so it broke out in a civil war. A lot of Igbos died. People starved to death. And eventually they gave up and came back to Nigeria. So the PTSD that Igbo people have had from this experience, and it's a history that the war only happened in their region. The rest of Nigeria went on as if nothing happened. And so since they came back, they've tried to stay away from the political scene as much as possible. They've just focused on business and everything.
I'm sorry, I do not agree with that, that they try to stay away from the political scene. You can't, I don't think it is right to say people try to stay away from the political scene when they are not even allowed. They can't even participate because people won't vote for them. So it is, when an Igbo person comes out and say, I want to be the president, people will automatically say no, because when you get into that position, you are going to try to succeed.
Okay.
So the reason why I said that, I don't disagree with you, but the reason why I said they tried to stay away from the scene was because for a long time, they've only participated in politics within their region. When it comes to the calling the big shots like presidency and all of that, this is the first time that we're having a serious contender from the East. Most times, they focus on the governorship elections and that's all. They don't really participate in the general. That's what I was trying to say. They've not really had representation in that sense. But this time around, that changed. And if you understand Nigerian politics, the PDP and the APC have been a ruling party. Our constitution says that we have a multi-party system, but in reality, we have a two-party system.
Okay.
And all major representation comes from either the PDP and APC.
Okay.
PDP and APC are practically the same.
That sounds familiar.
Yes.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And I must really state that the APC, I am 28 years old.
Yeah.
All my life, the APC has ruled Lagos State.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, just one person has been the same person.
Sorry, one person?
Yes, so not one, just one person. Every other governor that we have has been appointed by that person. Yes. So it directly has all the power, and presently that person is the president elect
of Nigeria.
My God.
So Tinubu.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yep.
Wow.
Do you know what?
I wasn't expecting that. I thought this was going to be a very short story. Short story. That was a short. That's it.
What I'm saying is, we're having you back on. I want some key Nigerian, African historical lessons here.
We're going straight to another studio. We're continuing this.
Honestly, I'm going home. Do you know what's going to happen when I go home? Yeah, Wikipedia, YouTube video. I'm taking notes. I'm ready to fight back with you guys next time we have you on. But
that's it.
Honestly,
from a distance.
And in a nutshell as well. Yeah. I am impassioned. I'm actually shaking a little bit. Again, I feel the need to say thank you
for the historical lesson,
for your contributions.
Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. That was fascinating. And once again, thanks a million for all that you do. It's such incredible work. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for now on the Black and Irish podcast. To listen to our full catalogue of episodes, check out rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. The series podcast coordinator for RTE is Paul Moriarty. Thanks for listening.